This is a 3-part episode. Come back next Wednesday for part 2.
Kind of jumping back, when I was younger, I had tendencies towards, you know, suicide. Like I had thought about it. I had attempted when I was younger, much younger. And so I kind of felt this spiral when I was, you know, now in my mid-20s.
Welcome to the American Grown Podcast, hosted by Austin Sullivan. The American Grown Podcast will focus on people from different walks of life and their journey to where they are now. Now, turn up your volume and settle in for a great episode.
This is the American Grown Podcast, recorded inside the ColorTech Creative Solutions Studios. This episode is brought to you by these sponsors.
Navigating the college journey can be overwhelming, but it doesn't have to be. At College Knowledge Foundation, we're here to guide students and families every step of the way. From choosing the right college to crafting standout essays and understanding financial aid, our virtual sessions and free consultations provide the tools you need to succeed. Join the growing community of students and families who've discovered how to take control of their college journey. Visit College Knowledge Foundation to learn more, book a session, or explore our free resources today.
Are you in the mood for some mouth-watering Italian dinners? Homemade bread, cheese steaks, hot subs, cold subs, salads, sides, and of course, delicious pizza? Look no further than Angelo's, located at 1032 South 5th Ave, Lebanon. Call 717-273-8579 to place your order now. Haynes Auto Detailing, run by owner Josh Haynes, offers a professional service that is sure to have your vehicle shining from wheel to wheel. My wife and I both trust Josh with our personal vehicles, and believe me, with 2 kids, the back seats tend to look like a hot mess. But after a trip to Haynes Auto Detailing, the vehicles look better than brand new, both inside and out. Message Haynes Auto Detailing on Facebook or call 717-679-3673 to get your vehicle looking right today. Are you in the mood for getting out of your house this evening? Head over to Boyer's Tavern in Rexmont, PA. They have appetizers, soups, salads, wings, mouth-watering burgers, sandwiches, and many other entrees to choose from. Proper food and drinks made by slightly improper folks. Head over to Boyer's Tavern today or give them a call at 717-450-4063. In this episode, we have Shayna McDonald, founder and president of Inner Seating Foundation, along with Bruce Lindsay, honorary board member. Shayna and Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you both for making the trip in. It's exciting, and I'm excited to learn about your backgrounds and also your nonprofit. But before we dive in, I want to shout out Randy McKillop for introducing us. He was on the podcast last year. It was a 2-part special. It was episode 75 and 76 for the listeners out there. So shout out to Randy if you're listening. Greatly appreciate it, bud. Thank you for introducing us. And how do you know Randy real quick?
Actually, just through working with the nonprofit, we connected at a couple of events, and we just had so many things in common that we did a few things together with Randy, so
yeah,
developed a friendship, and just excited to see what he does.
Awesome, awesome. Mm-hmm. So again, shout out to you, Randy, if you're listening. Thank you. So before we really dive in to Inner Seating Foundation and what all you offer and what all you do, yeah. From what I found, veterans, active military, first responders, and I mean that's the nonprofit helps all those people, which is phenomenal. Let's get some background on each of you and what you do and your early childhood and go as in-depth as you'd like. So, Shani, I'll start with you.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So, childhood. Okay. Well, I was that wild child. All right. I never really. Yeah. I could never, not bad wild. I was just, you know, I didn't have any structure. I would join like soccer teams, and I'd start picking flowers and doing cartwheels.
Oh, okay, I got so, you. So free I was, spirit, wild, yeah.
Yeah, so I wasn't necessarily the best person on your soccer team, But it was really great. Just a young childhood. I grew up in Palmyra. Okay. And then ended up going to Hershey, and I had a pretty close-knit family. We did a little bit of everything, traveling and things like that. So as I got older, I realized that there were some different dynamics as far as with the family. And as we talk about it later, I will go a little more into it. That mental health has been like a huge influence in my family history. So it was something that as I got older and recognized that I had to be more aware of, that unfortunately we did lose a couple of people in my family that took their lives. But it really helping this journey to get to where we are for the nonprofit has really been awesome.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear. I think mental health is so... It's not talked about enough, and it's so important to talk about and discuss, because everyone, and I mentioned this many times in many different episodes, but everyone's fighting different demons, you know, different struggles in life. You know, it could be something small, but to them it's big, you know, and it's very important. So mental health, I think, is huge, because you can see something if it's physically broken or not right, you know, if someone broke an arm or a leg, but mentally you can't see it, you know, it's nothing on the outside. So to have an organization or to have people, friends, family that support you and are there for you and check in on you, I think is huge. And it's very crucial. So in school, because I like to get kind of like a full background, sports, theater, anything like that, music?
Yeah, I got into a little bit of track, cross country. I like to run just to be outside, dabbled a little bit in theater. I ended up actually when I got done with college, which was for business.
Okay.
Because my parents gave me the, you need to go to college before you can go pursue that wild dream of singing.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I want to be a singer. I love it.
And so I did. I went to college for business, mainly marketing and visual. And then I went out to California. So as soon as I graduated, wow, a couple months later, booked it out to California. It was such an incredible experience for about 4 years. I think I can name drop just a little bit, but when I went out there, it was crazy, because within the first 2 weeks of being out there, I went out for a music school, but this really great lady introduced us to Stevie Wonder. And wow. So how crazy is it to get invited to dinner with Stevie Wonder?
That's
like
wild.
Your first 2 weeks in California.
That's crazy.
And so it just kept going on like that. It just seems so surreal. And I actually ended up working under Albie Shore. Really okay. Great guy. R&B artist. Not sure if you know from back in the like 80s. He was around with Bobby Brown, and so I had the really great opportunity of getting to know all of them as I worked with him, because he was traveling and he was touring and doing things like that. And I just remember while I was pursuing my music, he told me, he's like, you really have it, but I just don't know if you really want to do the fame thing. So he took me under his wing, and I got to see it, and he was very right.
Really? So
yeah.
So where'd you go to college real quick?
I went to Bradley Academy.
Okay.
Out in York.
Okay. So then you go to pursue a music career.
Yes.
Was your family supportive, parents supportive?
Yeah.
For the most part? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think they knew that I was going to do it. Like I was at least going to pursue it. But there were some things that they weren't prepared for. Unfortunately, like, you know, people were sending letters to them in Pennsylvania when I was out in California. That was a little unnerving how they got all that information. But that was, of course, like the early stages. I think MySpace was still.
Oh, wow. So that goes back a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, it goes back a little bit. Geez. So
and you get out there and you're meeting these people, but yet you come to realize like this lifestyle isn't for me. You don't like all the attention or.
Yeah, so there were two instances where it was just like, this just isn't for me. So I did see like Stevie Wonder, and I understand he's considered a legend. Yeah. So we're out to eat, somebody spots him. And the next thing you know, like you can't even eat because there's so many people that are surrounding him. And he did have great bodyguards that were like, hey, I'll get your information. Let him eat with his friends and family. Mm-hmm. And that was really great, but I didn't realize that that was like an all day, every day thing. And so when I was with Al and he wasn't even, I don't want to say anything like he wasn't at his peak, but his prime was back in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there was a time that we went to the Essence Festival. I think it was in New Orleans. And they had this huge convention center. And we were walking around and he was incognito. And all of a sudden, somebody's like, oh, that's Al B. Shore. And I kid you not, it took 4 hours to get police officers in to help escort us out because it was like a mosh pit. And it was just like, I don't know how people do this.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, I'm such a small town country girl. I don't know if I want this.
A little PA, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. I always thought about like celebrities, you know?
Yeah.
They have so much attention and fame, right?
Yeah.
The money's there, you know, in some cases. But it's like, it has to be such a lonely kind of life, you know? Because everybody wants a picture or wants your autograph. They want a piece of you, but yet they don't know you, you know? And they don't really take the time to know you. So I could see how coming from PA or any, you know, small state and going to like a big city or where, you know, Hollywood is and the fame and just you almost get mobbed. That's crazy. Yeah. 4 hours just to get police to help escort you out.
Yeah.
Wow.
And what people don't realize is even as a friend, it's hard to be a celebrity's friend or because everybody's like, oh, well, you know this person, so you can make connections. You can do this for me. You can do that for me.
Oh, they want to use. Yeah.
Use. And it's like, so if you know that you're a friend with them or they know that you're a friend with them, it gets really tough.
Yeah.
So it is a really small circle and it felt very isolating.
Well, I believe
it.
Yeah. At what point do you come back home? How do you get back to PA? Yeah.
Unfortunately, I got a call saying that my uncle had taken his life. And so I realized at that point, like, I didn't want to be away from family.
Yeah.
And so I came back and I left Al. I was like, I love this dream life. But at the same time, I realized like I needed to be with my family. And so that was really what brought me home was knowing that I didn't want to miss the moments that I could have with them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. So now, gosh.
Sorry.
No, I'm just, you know. Because it's such a real topic, you know what I mean? And suicide and losing loved ones. I mean, you know, it's like, how do you pick up those pieces and move on? And, you know, I love that you're like, look, because sometimes I feel like when you're younger, a teenager, and I'm in my early 30s, and I think now I'm starting to realize, like, mom and dad were kind of right, you know? And when you're younger, it's like, oh, you know, I know what I'm doing. I know what's better. But the fact that you were mature enough to be like, I need to come home. Like, I need to be with my people, be with my family, and not just chase maybe what could be a crazy dream. Maybe it would have been a reality. Maybe, you know, the next big pop star, but you're like, I need to come home and be with my family.
Right. You
know? Yeah, I think that takes a level of maturity because, again, how old would you have, if you don't mind me asking, what would this have been?
Yeah, so I went out when I was 18, and then it was about 4 years, so.
Okay. So that's what I mean. You'd be like early 20s.
Yeah.
I can think of some 20-year-olds that I know that would, you know, they'd be like, oh, this is my life now. This is what I'm doing.
Right.
And it's kind of crazy because like your family, for the most part, they have your back no matter what. You know what I mean? And they're there for you.
Right.
So for some young people to kind of abandon them. But I think as you get older, you kind of realize like, oh, no, family's everything really when it comes down to it.
Right.
You know?
And I would say that part of that is the isolation and that kind of leads into the story later too, is that when I was out there, even though I was living what people would consider the dream life, like I was touring, I was hanging out with celebrities. I mean, there wasn't really anybody that I didn't have access to. And it was great, but a lot of them have different lifestyles because they have to be, you know, different. And when you think about it, like you don't have friends. And I even tried working at a job, just a regular hotel job, and it was nice because it was kind of in a private area, so we did get more celebrities. So I knew quite a few of them that were coming in, and it was kind of nice to see friends. But there were a lot of people with working, like they would start rumors or they would say things that aren't true. And I'm like, I'm a nobody. Yeah. No, I don't have any really weight or anything out there. And I did have an opportunity to go with, I won't say the label, I'll just leave it. But the gentleman told me that I had to change who I was.
Oh.
And so not only am I being isolated, and, you know, things are getting a little weird with family, because I did have a family member when one of our friends was getting one of the Hollywood stars. Yeah. And they came up and they're like, oh, get me a backstage, you know, access thing. And I introduced them to Al, and they're like, oh, I'm such and such cousin of a famous person. And they're like, you're her cousin. She's closest to me. Why wouldn't, you know? So it was like name drop, name drop, name drop. And he was just such a humbling guy. Like, I, you know, I have nothing bad to say about Al, be sure. But he really showed me that when I went to this audition, they're like, we're going to have to change who you are. And I understood that I was the how do I say that nicely? The sex symbol of what they wanted. So they actually wanted to call me, oh, don't use this against me, but they wanted to call me Nikki Jaguar. And I was like, I do not look like a Nikki Jaguar. What?
So they want to change your whole persona. Your
my whole persona.
Everything about you.
Yeah. Wow. So my little country bumpkin was going to be more like Britney Spears' Pussycat like doll. And I'm like,
pop star.
Yeah. I'm like, that's just not me. And like, even the music, I like, I'm more, you know, I like country more now, but I love jazz growing up and just more laid back.
Yeah.
Pop was not my thing. So when they're like, yeah, we're going to give you this whole thing, I was like, no, I'm not really interested in that. And they said, well, listen, this is your time. And this was probably the moment that made my decision of not wanting to be in the industry, was that if you don't take this opportunity, this is your make it or break it now. You either take it, or you let somebody else who's more talented, more attractive, and more willing to do what we're asking them to do.
Wow.
So you either take this or you don't. And that was the moment I realized, like, I have to give up everything of who I am to have fame that seems so lonely.
Yeah.
And so then, of course, when I got the call about my uncle, I was like, it was almost a no-brainer.
Wow.
Yeah. Jeez.
Let's take a quick sip break. This sip break is brought to you by Garage Beer. From the garage to the cooler, whether you're on the golf course, just got done cutting your lawn on a hot summer day, or spending some quality time on the grill, grab yourself a Garage Beer. It's just beer-flavored beer. Your uncle has passed. Where do you go from there?
I start over. Like, I really had nothing. I, you know, I had pennies when I left, and unfortunately California is super expensive, so I had pennies when I came back. And I found a job I could actually walk to, and I started building through that. And about this time was when I really started to hit kind of a reality of my mental health, where the dream I always had was to be a singer, dancer, and that is gone now. And starting over, like, what dreams do I have, you know? And that was really hard. I ended up finding somebody that I ended up getting engaged to, and it ended up not working out. And that started to lead me on what I would call a spiral. Now, kind of jumping back, when I was younger, I had tendencies towards, you know, suicide. Like, I had thought about it. I had attempted when I was younger, much younger. And so I kind of felt this spiral when I was, you know, now in my mid-20s. after breaking off an engagement, and it was really hard for me. So all in this process, I am working at this great firm where they have this wonderful group called Toastmasters.
Okay.
And while I'm kind of dealing with this, I'm meeting new people and meeting encouraging people, and Bruce is actually one of them. And during this time, you know, he gives this speech, like, I'm just checking out Toastmasters at this point. I didn't really know what it was. And he, and I never get the speech right, but I always call it halo effect because that's what, like, sticks in my head. And he was, just telling this story about his experience. And the moment that I heard it, I was like, man, I have to get to know this guy. And and it just, like, something about that just kind of gave me a little bit of hope. And so while I had something that was somewhat stabilizing me, there was an event that happened, like, within that realm of time that actually is kind of the setup for what happened with how the foundation started.
Okay. All right. So let's, we got to get some background on Bruce. So maybe at this point we'll segue over, get Bruce's background story. And then if we can pick up where we just left off, I think that'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Bruce, let's get your backstory. Tell us about yourself.
Okay. Yeah. I might take a little longer than Shana because I'm almost twice as old as her.
Oh, come on now.
But
yeah.
So please. I was raised in Wellsboro, Pennsylvania, way up north. Wellsboro is a small town. I lived outside of the small town on a little farm. And family life was really good. Had my both parents were awesome parents, brother and sister. And it was not really a working farm. I tell people it was just a big enough farm to keep me out of trouble.
Okay.
So we had like 20 cows and we always had a horse or a chicken or
pig
or
something
like that.
Oh, that's a farm. Oh, yeah. In my mind, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It kept me busy. I had to fix fence, make hay, all that stuff. And I was a, my family was very much into education, and work ethic was a big part of my parents, what they taught me. We were literally, from the time we were very small, I was like, okay, go out and weed the garden, go feed the animals. You know, all that stuff was part of what I grew up with. Mm-hmm. But academically, loved reading, loved learning about everything I could get my hands on. And that was just part of what I learned as a kid. I had a big interest in history. My grandparents lived just off the battlefield of Gettysburg. So every time we came down to Gettysburg, I was crawling around on the cannons. And then I would want to go read a book about the Civil War. Okay. And I read books after books. And I was reading, you know, a 400-page book when I was in fourth grade, you know, about the personal history of U.S. Grant, which I still have.
Oh, wow.
And when I was 7 years old, I believe, my dad made me a cannon out of some old Amish wagon wheels and a telephone pole.
That's awesome.
And so I still have a cannon. This is the third or fourth. It's a wooden cannon that sits in my front yard. You've probably seen it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, doesn't everybody have a cannon in their front yard?
They should, right? They should.
So yeah. I would do, that's great. You know, between that and all the reading, I gravitated towards patriotism. I grew up during the Vietnam War, and it was not a time when everybody thought that way, but my dad was a veteran. He was drafted in the Army after Korean War, so he didn't serve in wartime, but he was a draftee, and he spent his time in the Army. Everybody around me growing up was a veteran. We had our farm, the one on the other side. I didn't know the details at the time, but he was a Marine veteran. He had served on Iwo Jima. He was actually wounded on Iwo Jima. The farm on the other side was a paratrooper in the South Pacific, also served in combat. And my sixth grade teacher was also a Marine officer, and he served in the South Pacific as well. And he was one that made the point that he made us when he said the Pledge of Allegiance. He said, when you say it, I want you to think about what you're saying and say it with meaning. Don't just repeat it. And that kind of stuck with me. There was a time, during that time, there was kind of a big divide in the United States about patriotism versus not really liking your country and burning the flag and all of that.
Yeah.
And because of the people that I grew up around, I was very much on the patriotism side. I always thought that our country was great, but because I had read so much, it wasn't really blind patriotism. I saw the good, the bad, and the ugly, but I still thought, you know, there's not really another country that's done it quite as well as we have, and people really want to come here, so we must be doing something right.
Yeah.
And so as I got further into high school, I started thinking about going into the service. And I had read a lot about, I thought about going to West Point. And then I started thinking, I started reading. The more I read about the Marine Corps, the more I thought that's really where I wanted to go. And I knew as I got closer to graduation that you could get there through the Naval Academy, but I didn't really want to go that route. So as I got close to graduation, I learned about the ROTC program and that you could become a Marine officer through the Navy ROTC program. And that was really where I wanted to go. I wanted to be a Marine officer.
Yeah.
I also did pretty well academically. So I was able to get a scholarship to Penn State and went there on a full scholarship, which was a really great.
Oh, that's awesome.
A really great option for me at the time. So having had an academic background, I was also in football and several other academic and extracurricular activities. So I was involved in a lot of things in high school. And then going to Penn State, again, Wellsboro is a small town where the flags line the street on Memorial Day, 4th of July, Veterans Day, and very patriotic. I kind of figured that everybody thought that way.
Yeah.
And what I didn't realize is this is 1980. Vietnam had only been over for 5 years. And I went to Penn State, and of course, nobody had a high and tight buzz cut. Yeah. I did because I was a Marine officer candidate.
Right, right.
And starting to hear like people kind of yelling things out the window that were not complimentary towards the military, so to speak. I'll put it just bluntly. And I thought, that's really weird. I didn't understand that at all. But that kind of pushed me towards just gravitating towards the other officer candidates that I knew. And that was my friend group during my time in college. And it wasn't, there were some people who go through the ROTC program and they're, you have to go once a week and they pay your bills. And that's about it.
Yeah.
I went what you would call kind of the hardcore route. There was a boxing team. We would go work out at 5:30 in the morning, three times a week.
Oh, wow.
And then at 6:30, the regular workout started. So from 5:30 in the morning till probably 7:30 in the morning, at least three times a week, I was at the gym with just that group doing boxing and all kinds of other exercises to get people in shape to get to OCS, Officer Candidate School. And then we would drill at 11 o'clock at night. So
it was
a big part of what I was doing. And I did okay. I was an engineering major. A lot of people who went into the ROTC knew they were going to become an officer. They didn't have to worry about, I'm not going to be an engineer. That's too hard.
Yeah.
But I decided that I wanted to do that because I was interested in science and I wanted to get a good degree while I was getting this free education. So I went through the 4 years at Penn State and graduated. OCS was between my junior and senior year down in Quantico, Virginia. It's a very grueling 6 weeks. They definitely are trying to weed you out if they don't think you belong.
Okay, so they try to break you. They want to see how committed you are.
Maybe. Yeah, and it's not, having worked at, I later worked at the Marine Corps boot camp, which is for the enlisted ranks. And it's kind of funny because OCS is actually physically harder, but less mentally stressful.
Okay.
Whereas boot camp for the recruits is very mentally stressful. It's still physically challenging, but at Officer Candidate School, they expect you to go in with a high physical fitness test score and be ready to hit the road running. And they don't yell at you quite as much, but you put the pack on and you start hiking around the hills and they expect you to keep up from day one. They don't expect that you're going to show up and have to get you in shape like they do at boot camp. So Officer Candidate School, I did well there. The next, after graduation, I got commissioned as a lieutenant And you go back to the basic officer course, which is again back at Quantico, that's about a year. And all Marine officers go through that. If you're a helicopter pilot, artillery, jet pilot, or an infantry officer, you still go to the basic officer course. So that's one of the things that makes the Marine officer corps unique, because every single officer, even if you're flying and dropping bombs, you know what the person on the ground, you know them personally.
Yeah.
So if it, it kind of keeps a bond of brotherhood together. The I took that really seriously. I did very well at the basic school. And then the follow-up to that is the infantry officer course, which is really grueling. That's when only the subcategory who are going to be infantry officers go for another 8 weeks or 10 weeks. I'm not sure how much it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you really focus on the tactics, and you're going to be a platoon commander. You're going to get a rifle platoon of Marines. You really better know what you're doing. And part of it, I think I did well because having grown up in the country, I was hunting and fishing and walking around in the woods. I had taught orienteering, so the land navigation and the weapons, I was all familiar with them.
Yeah,
so I did really good. There's the military skills, the academics, and the leadership. And I had kind of a good background in all of them, so I did pretty well in the basic officer course and infantry officer course. And then you get to select either East Coast or West Coast. You're going to Camp Lejeune or Camp Pendleton. That's about it.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought I wanted to go out west. I thought that would be a good place to just see the other side of the country. And so I went to Camp Pendleton after I graduated from the basic school and IOC. And I was in 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, 1st Marine Division. And I was assigned to Alpha Company, 1st Platoon. Wow. So people think that's kind of made up because I was 1st Platoon, Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment, 1st Marine Division for a period of time. That was my 1st Platoon. And I had really good experience with the staff NCOs. It's a really interesting dynamic because here I am, I'm 23, my first time in the actual Fleet Marine Force. And the staff sergeant, you technically outrank them, but they have 10 or 12 years experience.
Whoa, how was that? What was that like? Yeah.
It depends on the way I say it is, it's the staff NCO's job to train a lieutenant without them knowing they're doing it.
Ah, okay.
Because sometimes the officer gets a little ego going and they're like, I'm not going to listen to you because I outrank you.
Yeah.
But if I had really good staff NCOs, they were very good at letting me know when I needed to listen to them and when it was my turn to say my part. And so that dynamic worked really well for me. And I could tell you those that were really, really good at that. And the officer doesn't usually know that that's happening.
Yeah.
But the staff NCOs are good. Are like, I'm going to train a lieutenant. And if he resists this training, then there's going to be tension. Whereas if you can keep your ego in check, then you learn from this person who's actually way senior to you. So I had a rifle platoon, which is really, that's basically 30 grunts, rifles, you know, automatic weapons and grenade launchers. And they're the ones who, you know, run up the hill and take the hill. The rifle company has a heavy weapons platoon. So after a while at the first year, a new lieutenant came in. I gave my rifle platoon to him, and then I went to the heavy weapons company. That has 60 millimeter mortars and assault weapons and the heavy machine guns. So I had the weapons platoon for the first deployment that I went on. And the deployments are, they call them West Packs. It's a Western Pacific. And if you ever see on the news, there's 1,500 Marines off the shore of X country because there's disruption, that is an amphibious ready group. And there's usually four ships, helicopters, Marine Infantry Battalion, and we just float around. They call it a float sometimes because you go around, and when something kind of boils up, they go closer, so they're right offshore in case something happens. If nothing happens, you go around in the Western Pacific, you go to the Philippines, you go to Korea, We went in Hong Kong was a port of call. Singapore was a port of call, but we went to a lot of the islands in the South Pacific. I was fortunate enough to go to the island of Iwo Jima, which is not typically a port. There's no port there. It's a tiny little island. And because of its historic significance for a Marine to actually land on that island, it's sacred ground.
Yeah.
And I did an operation there, which I'll mention a little bit more about that later. But it was fun. There were a few incidents, and one of the things that we'll get into later is even during peacetime, there were people who died on every deployment that I had. Mostly helicopter crashes.
Okay.
The first deployment that I was on, we were sitting there one morning and, you know, where's Lieutenant Milne? He was here this last night. His helicopter went down. They found no trace of him or the helicopter.
Whoa.
And several Marines died in that. The helicopter had a malfunction and it was too far away from the ship, couldn't get back.
Yeah.
And they found an oil slick and that was it. And so one day you're sitting by this person and then the next day they're just gone. And it's something that you don't necessarily think is going to happen during peacetime. 1 month later to the day, we were doing a drill on the ship just to get ready. So it was an amphibious helicopter ship. That's how the Marines would get to shore. So it was a helicopter carrier, small aircraft carrier. So they said, okay, we're going to drill. You're going to get in, put your pack on. You're going to get in the helicopter. It's going to take off and you're going to go around and around in circles and then land again back on the ship.
Okay.
So, okay. Just to practice.
Sounds routine, right?
So we get on the helicopter. Well, between now and then, we found what the issue was. The helicopter has this system that keeps the two rotors. It's the twin rotor CH-46. You got to have those synchronized so they don't hit each other. Well, what had happened to the other one was that synchronization went out. The helicopter's propellers hit each other, and it drops like a brick. So this day, 1 month later, we get in the helicopter. We start to take off. So it lifts straight up, and then it kind of tilts over and starts going off the side of the ship. And I hear this noise, and it turns into kind of like a bull riding scenario where there's things thrown, you're getting thrown around and you hear this really loud clacking and you're like, this is not right. Yeah. And I looked off to the side and there was the ocean on one side and the deck on the other side. And I didn't know whether we were still over the deck or not. But like I said, when the rotors eat each other, the helicopter becomes a brick and it fell. And it fell directly back onto the deck of the ship. And it was kind of like maybe 15 feet in the air, which is high enough to be a jolt.
Oh, yeah.
No one was injured, but everyone was kind of shaken. And I don't like helicopters ever since.
Oh, yeah, I don't blame you.
Wow. That was the biggest incident where all of a sudden it dawned on me that this process that we're doing is dangerous, even in peacetime. And, you know, I was thinking this is what happened a month ago. And had we been 10 feet to the left, we would have been in the water and a drop would have been 50 feet. And Whoa. It would have been iffy whether anybody even survived the fall. Otherwise, mostly uneventful. There was a lot of unrest in the Philippines where there were several times. The closest I ever got to combat was, hey, we're going to pass out ammunition because this is a live fire event and there are things going on that you need to lock and load and go out, and nothing ever happened. But that was where it's like, okay, things are getting real here. You've got to be mentally prepared for whatever might happen. That was the first deployment. Came back from that deployment and I decided I want to stay in the infantry battalion. I became the platoon commander of the mortar platoon, which is there's rifle companies, then there's a heavy weapons company now.
Okay.
I've got a platoon of the 81 millimeter mortars, which are really big, and it's the largest man-carried weapon that an infantry battalion has, 80 Marines. And now you're firing long distances. You have to know how artillery works. Basically, it's a small-scale artillery platoon. And I was with them for two straight years. Had a really good deployment with them. and went overseas again. Came back after I had been in 4 years. And at this point, I'm wondering where I'm going to go next. I got orders to go to the Marine Corps Recruit Depot San Diego, which is where the boot camp on the West Coast is. A little backstory on that.
Yeah.
There's a monitor. That's who decides where everybody's going to go. So the infantry monitor had a meeting with us and said, what would you like to do? And I really wanted to stay in the fleet. I didn't want to go train recruits. That was something I knew everybody could do. Everybody did that. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to do it. And they said, well, there's this thing called the Aerial Observer School, which is you fly around in the plane and you look down and you spot for artillery and the fighter jets to drop bombs. I really wanted to do that. He said, yeah, you can do that. And then I got orders out of the blue to go to the recruit depot, which is where I didn't want to go.
Oh, no.
And I was kind of upset about that. A little backstory on that. So this is 1988. I get sent to Marine Corps Recruit Depot, which turned out to be a great duty station because you're working with the drill instructors who are the cream of the crop of the Marine NCO Corps. Can't say enough about that tour. It was just being around, watching the recruits go from coming off the bus in the middle of the night, getting their heads shaved.
Yeah.
And you think every time, this is the worst group we've ever had. And then, you know, 12 weeks later, it's like, this is the best Marines we've ever produced.
Yeah.
And how did they do it? It's just a miracle to watch the drill instructor. So the officer's job is to oversee that. And during that time, 1990 is when Saddam invades Kuwait. Everybody who's in the active fleet Marine Force is deployed to Kuwait. I'm in recruit training because it's a recruit. They weren't going to close down the pipeline.
Right. Oh, no,
you
sure.
Still had to keep that going.
Definitely.
So I wasn't sent, and most of the people who were there weren't sent to the Mideast. And that happened. And fortunately, it was over very quickly. But there was definitely tense times. There was a meeting where the commanding general said, we're going to form what's called a casualty replacement unit. And what that means is they've ordered 10,000 body bags for the Middle East operation that's about to start tomorrow. We expect that some of you will go and some of you will become casualties. And we're going to put you in line. And when your name comes up, you're going to go be a replacement for someone who got killed, which was, that was kind of tense. So literally when I watched it on TV, like most of the people did, and when I saw that first day, when I saw the massive surrenders, I was like, this is going to be over quickly. I was really happy about that because we didn't know what was going to happen. We really expected massive casualties. But back to the Aerial Observer issue, the person who got that slot, there was one slot. The person who got it instead of me got killed. And
whoa.
I didn't know him personally, but he was a colleague. He was the same age group as me. And I've often thought how upset I was that I didn't get that slot. And I got sent to MCRD. And I ended up watching it on TV. And he got shot down and killed. So that kind of is one of those weird little twists. And like, you don't know where your career is going to go and who's going to be in the line of fire and who's not. I was at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot from 88 to 92. And I decided at that point, they want to send you to an advanced school. If you go there, you've got to stay in for 4 more years. And then you're at 12 and it's, you might as well stay in forever.
Yeah.
I had to think about it. Do I really want to be in this forever? Because when I went in, I wanted to be a platoon commander. And of course, everybody thinks they want to become a general. But I started watching the politics, and I had some really good leaders, and I had some who I know would have sacrificed my life just to make their name better. Mm-hmm. It's a roll of the dice. Which one are you going to get when you go to combat? Who's going to be in charge of you?
Yeah.
And I started thinking about that. Also the family issue. So in 1988, I got married, been married for 37 years now.
Oh, congrats. That's awesome. Yeah. Seriously.
I watched also the difficulty of family life when I was deployed and watching as a young lieutenant, the older officers would walk down the pier and the 2-year-old kid would say, I'm not going to go to him. I don't know him. And that was really hard. I was like, I don't know if I want to do that.
Yeah.
So I was really weighing, do I want to be a career officer or not? And there were several things that just kind of lined up that said, this is the time to get out. So I, as an officer, you don't have a specific time of enlistment. You are, if you're a regular officer, you stay in until you say, I want to resign. And so I put in my resignation and wanted to come back to Pennsylvania because my family had then, my parents had moved down to southern Pennsylvania. My sister lived here. So I really wanted to be back close to family, kind of like what Shayna said. And because of my academic background, I got a job as a research scientist, which I've done for 33 years now. And my thinking was, hey, I was an officer in the Marine Corps, but I'm just going to go away. I'm going to cut the strings and go away from that and become a civilian.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to figure out this little gem, which is you might not be on active duty anymore, but you will never be a civilian. And I don't know if all people think that way, but I was in really intense, you know, units that we were really training hard. And I don't see how you can be in it that deep and then just turn around and become a civilian. And it didn't really dawn on me. I liked the work that I did. I liked the fact that I was able to be with my family, but there was kind of a little empty thing that I didn't understand. And we can talk about this more, but I've talked about it as you are part of a tribe. That's the intensity that you're working next to these people that have the same passion and you're doing something that's really hard. And then all of a sudden you're around civilians and they don't have the same attitude at all. It's like, how do you guys even make it through the day?
Right.
And people would complain about things. I'd be like, you have no idea what hard
could
is.
Could be much worse. Yeah. Could be a lot harder.
And,
yeah.
And so literally like 10 or 15 years go by and I'm happy. I'm not, it's not like I'm depressed or anything, but there's just this little empty
something's missing part. Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And around the time that I started working in Toastmasters, it was also several things kind of lined up at once. I had, through social media, reconnected with a lot of the Marines that I'd served with 20 years before. And there's the good and the bad. Some of them had done extremely well, really, really well with their lives. And there was other ones who were struggling, and some of them just were not, they were underemployed. I knew how talented they were. They were very competent people,
yeah.
But they just kind of got out and drifted and didn't really live up to what they could have. Others had mental issues. Others had physical issues. And it started me thinking, well, was there something I could be doing to help them? Simultaneous with that, just locally, I live in Carlisle area and worked in the West Shore. There were several people who I knew that became part of the 22 a day. And I didn't know the person. There were relatives that I was like, I wish I would have known this person and I would have helped them. I would have done anything to keep them from going that route. Mm-hmm. And about that time is when I was in Toastmasters and I was working with Shayna, and her speeches kind of paralleled mine in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. She was doing some speeches that really brought home the mental health issues. And that was when I was kind of becoming aware of, these are my people, right?
Yeah,
this
right.
isn't just someone.
Brothers, you would say. Probably.
Right, exactly. Yeah. This is my family.
Yeah.
And if they need help, I'm just going about my life and I've done okay myself, but not all of them have. And why is that? How did they get off track? And why is it that veterans have that larger percentage that have these issues? And so, part of what I've talked to Shayna about is this idea of isolation. You take a person and you spend tens of thousands of dollars turning them into something completely different. Mm-hmm. And transition, they're a different person. They come out of that and it's like, okay, go back and be a civilian. It's not really going to
happen like that. Yeah.
And they do a lot of what they call transition training. And here's where you get your benefits. Here you can get your education benefits. And here's where you can go to the VA for whatever. But that's like a week-long thing. And then
that's it.
People get out and they might think they have it made. They don't want to stay in. They hated the organization, but they love the people.
Yeah.
And so now there's this kind of isolation. They're like, maybe there's a problem with their job, getting a job. Maybe they don't really take advantage of the education, or maybe they just kind of get into substance abuse because they're dealing with things. Now, these are people who are on top of just the tribal issue that I've spoken with. I didn't have any combat experience to deal with. So if you throw that on top of that, then there are people who can't share anything that they've experienced with the people that they're around, their family, their coworkers. They don't have anything in common with them and they can't really relate. And so that's when we talk, you know, Shana mentioned the word spiral, and that's what I saw happening with some of the people I know. They would maybe in some order lose their employment, then they would start the substance abuse, then they would lose their family, and then all of a sudden there was just some incident that set them off. And there was a lot that people, I would follow these guys on social media and say, oh, I don't have PTSD. And then like a couple days later, they would post, you know, I haven't slept through the night for 20 years. I'm like, dude, you got something. I don't know what you don't want to call it PTSD, but there's something going on that's not right.
No.
So I started reaching out to individuals, and then Shana and I, you know, Shana started some work that I thought was really relevant, and I thought that was a great thing. So I started working more closely with her. Then there's one incident that specifically happened. This is a strange series of events. I was working in Central Pennsylvania, but I had a meeting in Denver. On Sunday morning, I see a post that one of my Marines, who I worked really close with, knew really well, had taken an overdose. And he left a post saying, bye, I'm done. And I happened to be flying out to Denver that day. He was in a coma for a couple of days. And the third day or fourth day, Wednesday, I think, was my meeting wasn't over. And I went to the leader of the meeting. I said, I've got a Marine who's in Wyoming. He's 4 hours away. I'm leaving this meeting and I'm going to drive up there and see him. And so the day that he woke up, I was there.
Whoa. Yeah.
And actually, I talked to Shana on the way there because I knew she was someone who understood mental health issues. And I was like, what, you know, I'm not really used to this. What should I say? And we talked for about an hour while I was driving up there. And to this day, he's said, you were the first person who came to the hospital to see me. And that's a big deal. And so that's, again, that's like, that's a person who I knew personally, never thought he would have that kind of problem.
Yeah.
But when he did, I was like, this could happen to anybody.
Anybody.
And it's the struggle that you don't see. And I thought we could do something better.
Yeah.
So that's how I ended up starting to work with Shana, and I'll let you maybe pick up from there.
Yeah. So when we were talking about the speeches, I decided that I was going to join Toastmasters. And like I had said before, the engagement ended and I started to, you know, of course I was depressed. I will say I feel I was reasonably depressed. And I ended up having a conversation with a friend who I believe in good intention, but misunderstood some conversations. And they ended up starting this cycle of events, which they ended up calling crisis. And they, I guess, I'm not 100% sure how, but I can only tell you how it played out in my perspective.
Please, yeah.
So crisis was called on a Sunday, which I had been working at church all day. I had spent time with my family for the rest of the day, and I was just tired. I was drained. And, you know, when you're sad about something, it's hard to be on. And I was like, I'm not up to seeing this friend. And I canceled on them. And I said, I'm sorry. I just want to go home. I want to take a couple of sleep aids and go to sleep. Well, that somehow turned into that I was in danger to myself.
Stay tuned for for part two next week. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. To see photos of today's guests and more content, just search American Grown Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to be a featured guest on the podcast, please direct message or email Austin at AmericanGrownPod@gmail.com.
This episode was brought to you by these sponsors.
Modern Gent Customs is your go-to for all your custom apparel and headwear needs. From individuals to businesses, with no minimums or design fees ever, inquire today at info@moderngentcustoms.com.
Cleona Coffee Roasters is a small batch coffee roastery and coffee shop. Veteran and first responder owned, community oriented, and roasted fresh to order. Now open inside 911 Rapid Response, Anvil, PA. Go to CleonaCoffeeRoasters.com to order online, see updated hours, and find where you can buy it close to you.
Hostler Engraving is your local source for unique, quality-driven laser engraved gifts for all occasions. Place an order today by visiting our Facebook page at Hostler Engraving. You won't be disappointed.
Triggered 22 LLC, a veteran-owned apparel company. By purchasing a t-shirt, hat, or hoodie from Triggered 22, you're not only supporting a small business, but you're bringing awareness to veteran PTSD and suicide. Please help save the lives of those who fought for our freedoms. Visit triggered22.com now and place your order. Let's help those suffering from invisible wounds.